Welcome to Casting Hope, a sermon podcast of Hope Presbyterian Church in Columbus, Ohio. My name is Joe Hack, pastor at Hope, and we are so glad that you are listening in. We would love to connect with you in person at our Sunday gathering. In the meantime, we hope this message points you to Jesus, the reason we gather.
So when I was an angsty teenager, I loved discovering new music. But I hated sharing my discoveries with others. Can any of you relate to this? This is an interesting sickness, but I had it. I would discover this amazing band that was not on the charts, nor was it on the radio, nor was it on TV. But instead of getting the word out, I would kind of hoard this new discovery for myself. And I would jealously guard this band from the wrong kind of fans. Am I alone? No? Okay. There's at least one more of you out there. So this is what I did with music, and we often do something like this if we're honest with Jesus, because here's what happens. We discover Jesus, but instead of sharing Jesus with others, we kind of jealously guard him from the wrong kind of people. And we can do this with friends. We can do this with neighbors. And we can do this with enemies. When it comes to our friends who don't know Jesus, we might keep Jesus to ourselves. We kind of like the friendship the way it is. And we might be afraid that if introducing Jesus to this long-standing friendship happens, it will complicate and possibly down the road even ruin this good friendship. When it comes to our neighbors who don't know Jesus, we might share Jesus with those whom we think pre-qualify. There's folks that we can imagine being Christians, and there's folks that we would never imagine being Christians. There's folks we can imagine in these seats, and there's folks that we live next to that we cannot imagine in these seats. There's folks that we can imagine believing the core tenets of Christianity and in the resurrection of Jesus and the way of Jesus. And there are people that we cannot imagine embracing the way of Jesus. And we divide these people into pre-qualified and not pre-qualified. And we reluctantly share Jesus with those we think pre-qualify. And we hardly ever share with those we think do not. When it comes to our enemies, those who are against us, those maybe that we think are against us, or those we are against, we resist sharing Jesus. And the logic is like this. It's hard to imagine sharing something we cherish so much with someone we really don't like. This attitude actually reminds me of the Old Testament prophet Jonah. I could call this attitude the Jonah impulse. If you remember, Jonah was sent by God to where? Nineveh, the capital city of Assyria. But when he was called to go to Nineveh, the capital city of Assyria, he went in the opposite direction. Oh, he loved God. He hated Assyria. They were his enemy. And Jonah decided Nineveh did not pre-qualify for God's mercy. Maybe you know what happens. A big fish gets involved. Jonah ends up going to Nineveh after all. And the very thing Jonah did not want to happen happened. His enemy embraces his God and receives his God's mercy. And this infuriates Jonah. From Jonah 3, we read this. This change of plan, so God's mercy instead of judgment, greatly upset Jonah, and he became very angry, so he complained to the Lord about it. Didn't I say before I left home that you would do this, Lord? That's why I ran away from Tarshish. I knew that you are a merciful and compassionate God. slow to get angry, filled with unfailing love, and you are eager to turn back from destroying people. Just kill me now. Lord, I'd rather be dead than alive if what I predicted will not happen. So deep was his hatred. Jonah wanted the mercy of God to be a private lake, not a public river. He wants God's mercy for himself. Do you see it? And get this, he wants God's mercy for people like him. Not something that crosses borders like a river. Not something he can't control. The Jonah impulse on display. This same Jonah impulse is on display in the text we heard read to us this morning. And so if you have a Bible, we can look closer at this text. It's Luke 4. I'll put a lot of the text on the screen if you're following along. Luke 4, starting in verse 16. And so in this text, what happens is Jesus begins his ministry in his hometown of Nazareth. Look at verse 16. There are more people in your high school's graduating class than there are in Nazareth, okay? These men and women knew Jesus intimately. And verse 16 tells us that he went into the synagogue, which was his habit. Of course it was. And he stood up to read, and the scroll of the prophet Isaiah was handed to him. And so he unrolls the scroll, and he finds a couple verses in Isaiah, and then he reads them. He reads them. The Spirit of the Lord is on me, because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners and recovery of sight for the blind, to set the oppressed free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. And then he sits down. And friends, in those days, when someone sits down, they are entering into a posture of teaching. And he preaches an 8-word sermon. Today, this scripture is fulfilled in your hearing. Basically saying, you don't need a long sermon, you just need to look at me. I am this text in flesh. I am the yes to this promise in every way. And this excites his little crowd of friends and family. They praised him in verse 15. They were transfixed in verse 20. They thought he spoke well in verse 22. They were amazed in verse 22. Now, friends, Jesus' sermon is not over. If you were listening along, he detects something in their hearts. Maybe he detects the Jonah impulse. They love his grace for themselves. But what about others? Not so much. How do we know? Well, their praise turns to rage in the space of 2 paragraphs. That's how we know. And in those 2 paragraphs, Jesus says something that exposes their Jonah impulse. Specifically, he tells 2 stories from the Old Testament. Elijah's ministry to the desperate widow in Zarephath, in Elisha's ministry to Naaman the Syrian with a skin disease. What do you notice about these 2 people? What do you notice? Ponder that. Consider that for just a moment. What do you notice? What could possibly create his hometown's praise turn to rage? New Testament scholar Diane Chen, she writes, common to Elijah and Elisha's stories was their mission to those despised by reason of their gender, woman, marital status, widowed, Gentile origin, Sidonian and Syrian, and physical deformity, leper. Nazareth thought that only they, hang on for that one, if you saw that. Going somewhere with that one. Don't miss this though. Nazareth thought they only pre-qualified for these gracious words of Jesus. And they get outraged that Jesus would come for others. They wanted Jesus for themselves. And they wanted Jesus on their own terms. In a way, they were treating Jesus like a team mascot. I did a little research on the history of the team mascot, the French word mascot. Anybody speak French? Is that how you say that? Mascot? Mascot? Anybody? Okay. M-A-S-C-O-T-T-E means lucky charm, essentially. And the very first team mascots were live animals, and some still to this day. Fans thought these animals were good luck for their team and bad luck for the other team. And then something significant happened in 1965. The costumed mascot was born. And actually in our backyard. And so I'm reading from Jeff Marzik. Quote, the shift from live to costume mascots was spearheaded by Major League Baseball's Mr. Met of the New York Mets and Brutus Buckeye of the Ohio State Buckeyes in 1964 and 1965, respectively. Now, we should feel proud of this, right? Did you know that we were close to having a buck, like a deer buck, as the mascot? Did you know that? Because, you know, live animals were all the rage and were the bucks. But we can thank two college students who decided to get out the paper mache and do that instead. And the rest is history, friends. This is when Brutus is born. There's been some changes across the years. But here's my point. Nazareth adored Jesus the way that we adore Brutus. Jesus was their Jesus. Jesus was their mascot. Jesus was their lucky charm. Jesus was their grace. Jesus was their mercy. Jesus was their favor of the Lord. Not Michigan. Or whoever we deem our enemy. Or unworthy. Jesus wants to challenge this Jonah impulse in all of us, this mascot mentality, and he does so in this text in two ways. Number one, Jesus won't let us define him on our own terms, and Jesus won't let us confine him on our own terms. Let's look at the first. Jesus won't let us define him. And we see this in the first seven verses of our passage. 16 through 22. Jesus sets the agenda on the front end of his ministry with this passage from Isaiah. Friends, this is the Jesus agenda. This is what he is about. In fact, everything we read about Jesus in the Gospel of Luke from this point forward has some kind of tie to what we see in this Isaiah text. I'll put it on the screen. I like Joel Green's literal translation of this passage. What we see in this passage is at least two things about Jesus' ministry. The first is that Jesus is all about God's favor. And so look at this text. Jesus is quoting Isaiah 61, verse 2, the very end, to proclaim the year of the Lord's what? Favor. But if you were reading Isaiah, and if you had Isaiah memorized in your mind, which you did, if you were spending your days in a synagogue, you did. You had it memorized. You know what comes next. And what comes next in Isaiah 61:2 is, and the day of vengeance of our God. Okay? So what's happening? This is a scandalous omission that everybody would notice, which is why they were amazed at what they called his gracious words. Jesus wants us to know that he came not to judge the world, but to save it and to open a window of mercy. Judgment will come. We read that in the Bible very clearly. And Jesus, in his second coming, brings that. But until that day, Jesus is extending grace to all who know their need. Scandalous favor to all who know their need and embrace Jesus as their rescue. Secondly, Jesus is all about release in this text. You see that word release in the middle and towards the end. Some translations, freedom or freeing or liberty. His ministry is one of release. The captives, the oppressed, Isaiah says. Those who are locked in. Those who are kind of trapped in the rubble of circumstances. Those who are trapped in the rubble of abuse. Those who are trapped in the rubble of their own making because of their sin. And these folks have no escape and they know it. They don't have a key to get out. But Jesus comes, he says, to bring release. He wants to release. He is good news to the poor, not just material poor, but definitely material poor, but also socially, spiritually, physically. His ministry embodies the year of the Lord's favor, which was a shout out to the year of the Jubilee in the Old Testament. This was a day in which Israel would release slaves and debts and even overburdened soil. And it pointed to this day of recreation, this renewal of this earth that is not the way it is supposed to be. You know, like we often say, quoting Michael Williams, God made it, we broke it, Jesus fixes it. That's the story of the Bible in 9 words. How does Jesus fix it? He tells us right here. Release. And this explains his ministry of miracles. This explains his ministry of healing. This explains his ministry of exorcism, which we will encounter time and time again in our journey through Luke. Release from oppression. Release from sickness. Release from bondage. Release from the rubble that we find ourselves trapped inside. As a kid, I was really into corny magic shows. I was. I liked doing them. I liked watching them. I would beg my parents to go to the local magic store. We had one of those in Muncie, Indiana. And I would beg them to go there so I could buy a new magic trick. And I would spend hours learning card tricks. And I once built a trick out of a large refrigerator box where it looked like it was an illusion. Okay, don't go any mistakes. I wasn't doing magic. I was doing illusions. And I put a rope across the refrigerator box and I would walk through the rope to my neighbor's friend's amazement. Yes, I was very cool. I would do magic shows for my friends. Well, for the longest time, I thought that Jesus' ministry of miracles was like that. Do crazy, impossible things to wow people into belief. That's why Jesus is healing. That's why Jesus is doing miracles like turning water into wine. That's why Jesus is doing exorcism so that people would be like, wow, I want to believe in you now. No, Jesus does ministry and miracles to release, to show the world what his final renewal will look like. His ministry of miracles and exorcisms is, in a way, a preview of what creation is designed to look like in real time. No sickness, no death, and no demons and evil. No oppression. So do you see it, friends? Jesus is defining Jesus on his own terms. And we must allow Jesus to define his own agenda. We don't get a vote. He is on the move. He's not a mascot for our team. He's not a good luck charm for us and the people we deem worthy of him. He's Jesus. He He's Christ. He's Lord of all. And he comes to bring grace. He comes to bring relief. He comes to bring release. And he comes to bring favor to all who know their need and trust in Jesus. All. All who know their need and trust in Jesus. So Jesus won't let us define him. But we should finally say that Jesus won't let us confine him either. If you look again at verse 23, Jesus said to them, "Surely you will quote this proverb to me, 'Physician, heal yourself.' And you will tell me, 'Do here in your hometown what we have heard you do in Capernaum.'" And so Jesus knows what they are thinking, and he anticipates it. They're thinking something along these lines. "Jesus, I love this ministry of release you're talking about. This is great. But do it here. Physician, heal yourself," meaning heal you and your families. Do what you're saying you're going to do right here and among yourself. If you're this great doctor, like you're saying you are, do it here, not there. Understand? But Jesus won't let them confine him like this. Instead, Jesus reveals two things in his words. Number one, that Jesus came for outsiders who know their need. Jesus came for outsiders who know their need. He embodies the ministry of Elijah and Elisha in this way. Luke expert Joel Green writes, "Jesus underscores that, quote, 'good news to the poor.'" Okay, that phrase from Isaiah that Jesus says, "I am this." This phrase, "good news to the poor," embraces the widow, the unclean, the Gentile, and friends, important to our context, those of lowest status. If you look at what happens next in the Gospel of Luke, sure enough, Jesus is healing the outsider, those with the lowest status, but those who know their need. But this does not mean that Jesus rejects insiders just because they are insiders. Because we could also say Jesus came for outsiders who know their need. He came for insiders who admit their need. You see, the problem isn't just insider status for Jesus. It's that their insider status keeps them and blinds them from really seeing Jesus. Don't miss that Jesus starts his ministry with his own people, his own hometown. This is not just performative. He starts with his own friends and family. He offers release and grace there too. They just want it on their terms. They miss Jesus. Luke doesn't tell us, but I actually wonder if Jesus' own brothers are in the synagogue that morning. I wonder that. We know at least from the Gospel of Mark that his own brothers say that he is out of his mind. Jesus entered a house and again a crowd gathered so that he and his disciples were not even able to eat. And when his family heard about this, they went to take charge of him, for they said, "He's out of his mind." But consider this, James, who is one of Jesus' brothers, Jude, who is one of Jesus' brothers, are insiders of all insiders, aren't they? Who don't get Jesus, at least as far as Mark 3, verse 20. Miss an insider who misses out on Jesus. But Jesus doesn't give up on them. He rescues and saves them too. And now we have their letters in our New Testament. Jesus came for the outsider who knows their need. Jesus came for the insiders who admit their need. I'm somebody who grew up in church. And a lot of voices around me sort of embedded in me this idea that I was a good young man. You're a good young man. You love the Lord. You're what this world needs. You know, messages like that. And that was great to hear affirmation like that. But what it did do negatively is it blinded me to my need. But one day, Jesus allowed me to see my need for him and that my selfishness ran very deep. And my self-reliance matched that of the most hardened Pharisee. And that was a hard pill to swallow, but ultimately it was a very loving thing to do from Jesus to show me that, because without it, I would still be far from Jesus. Relying in my own efforts, relying in my own goodness, relying in my own religious observance and morality. But instead, Jesus mercifully came to me and patiently waited for me to see my own need for him, even though I was an insider of all insiders. I was making awesome comments in Bible studies. People were like, man, you're so insightful about the Bible. You're such a good leader for Jesus. I was so far from him until I saw my need. I actually see in this strange ending of our passage, and I'll put it on the screen as we close, I see mercy here. I see mercy. This passage is strange to me. I'll read it. All the people in the synagogue were furious when they heard this. They got up, drove him out of the town, and took him to the brow of the hill of which the town was built in order to throw him off the cliff. And this verse, I have trouble imagining this one, but it's striking for that reason. But he walked right through the crowd and he went on his way. And friends, I see something merciful there. Jesus does not retaliate with severe judgment. He doesn't zap them for their rejection. Even they're actually very close, if not no different, from the devil in the wilderness at this moment that we just read about. They are essentially trying to stop God's rescue mission from happening right then and there, just like the devil in the wilderness. But Jesus, as I said, he doesn't get even. He walked right through the crowd and he went on his way. And where is he going? What is his way? And what does his way lead to? It leads to the cross. It leads to the cross of Calvary, where he would surely die for the sins of many who were in that scene. You see, Jesus will not allow us to define him or confine him. These rocks here are, many believe, the rocks upon which Nazareth was built. That was very much referenced there. And it's striking to me to imagine Jesus leaving that scene on mission to rescue even the hardened person against him. Let me ask you just a couple questions as we close. One is very direct, and it's this. Do you know the real Jesus? Or is the Jesus you follow a Jesus of your own making? Is the Jesus you follow made out of paper mache to be your mascot, to be your lucky charm, to serve your purposes? Here's a good question to ask, myself included. When was the last time something Jesus says or does angered you, like this crowd? Created in you a response, made you want to get rid of him even, wanted to push him out of your frame. If that's never happened to you, it might be a sign that Jesus is made in your own image and to your own liking. Because Jesus is very, very, very challenging to everybody. And here's the thing. Give him your upset. He can handle your upset. As he does here, he will walk through it in his love for you. He would rather you be upset with him and wrestle with him and trust in him then you live in an illusion with him. Second question I would ask is this. Are you carefully confining Jesus to yourself or to your preferred group of people. Like a zoo. You know, are you keeping the Lion of Judah in a small, safe, fenced-in faux safari with you and people like you? We're all guilty of putting an invisible fence leash, like we put on dogs sometimes, an invisible fence leash on Jesus, and we sort of bury the line ourselves, and we create the boundaries of who Jesus ought to interact with in our life, or who our church ought to interact with in our life. And we sort of are like, yeah, Jesus, we love you, but you're going to get zapped if you cross that boundary. Are we carefully confining Jesus to our own people or to ourselves? But here's the thing. If we're going to let this text do its work, Jesus is going to say to us this morning, graciously, he's going to say, I'm going to whomever I want to go to. You don't get a vote, but you can jump on board. He is not our mascot, but he is our Lord. I want to pray, Lord, would we be surprised by you afresh on this morning? Would we see Jesus for who he is in all of his wild and uncontainable glory? We just sit here for a moment, maybe praying in our own words quietly, pondering this with you. Who do we need to share Jesus with that we haven't? Lord, how have we made you into our own image, in our own liking, instead of the other way around? Finally, Lord, we ask this question. Are we needy? Do we know our need this morning? If we're not, make us so right now. You clearly are for those who know their need. And so we come now to you in our need and in your name. Amen.
Thanks for listening in. For more resources like this and to learn more about Hope, please visit our website at hopechurchcolumbus.org.